This week's episode is brought to you by Enable. Stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear Enable's Chief Security Officer Dave McKinnon talk about IT security for distributed workforces.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the IT News Podcast. Our guest this week is CBA's Chief Decision Scientist, Dan Jamin. Decision Science at CBA is responsible for several flagship customer-facing services, including the customer engagement engine that predicts the next best conversation for bankers to have with a customer, and the Benefits Finder, which directs banking customers to claim refunds and discounts they're entitled to, but may be unaware of. The function is also doing a lot of interesting work with the no-code machine learning platform H2O.ai, and we delve into this work specifically in this podcast. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Can you talk a little bit about the team that works on CBA's AI and data science and data decisioning efforts, and just maybe talk a little bit to the size and to the structure and maybe the mix of skills that are in that team?
I lead a team called Decision Science. We've got a few hundred people at this stage, and a lot of those are data scientists, AI professionals, but some of them are experimental scientists, behavioral scientists. Really, the idea behind Decision Science was to bring together a mix of people with a broad range of experience and ideas. And the idea being that if we bring these people together, we get a better outcome than would otherwise be the case. And actually, that includes a number of people in the team who started their career with the bank in the front line, dealing with customers every day. One of the ladies who worked with me to set up the customer engagement engine, our kind of flagship AI tooling, actually started her career working part-time in a branch in the Brisbane area for CommBank. And so we are part of a much larger data analytics function of a few thousand people. But really, the organization as a whole these days is data driven. So the way that we think about executing through that is a mixture of decentralized and centralized capability. And I think that's the most effective way, really, in a modern company to get benefit from the incredible opportunities of AI. So if you think about how things have kind of worked to date in a number of different companies, you tend to get two types of approaches. One would be that the data scientists would be given complete latitude to do whatever they want to do on the work, but they're not very well connected to the business and therefore find it hard to actually produce solutions that go into production. And the second would be that they are absolutely aligned to the business in a way that they are being directed by people who don't necessarily always understand the possibilities with AI. And so what we have is what I think is the best of both worlds. We have a community of experts in AI who share from each other, learn from each other. It helps us to focus education, sharing best practice, investments. And so we've got a really brilliant capability that the whole enterprise can use. And then we make sure that those are embedded within each of the business units so that they get to understand the real business problems. How do we really help customers? What would be a great outcome for our customers in each of those lines of business? So they're focusing their incredible capability on those business problems. And that, I think, is something that creates a great atmosphere in the bank. The team like it, but more importantly, our customers, I think, are getting a really great service from us in terms of what we've been able to do with AI.
So you actually have people that are embedded out in the different lines of business that are understanding those particular areas and feeding back to the central team, or are they developing out there as well?
Both, effectively. So if you think about a very common use case that we would have to provide better customer outcomes is to analyze unstructured text. And so in some areas of the business, that might be looking at customer feedback. In others, it might be looking at some of the things that our business partners have said about particular aspects of the products or services that we offer and suggestions. And so each of the embedded teams would have a really good understanding of the business that they're supporting and working directly with the people who understand that line of business. But it may be that they require some natural language processing expertise. We've got some really top class, world class NLP, natural language processing experts within the team. And so it's important that they get to deploy their skills where it really matters. So that's where the kind of mixture of the line of business versus the center of excellence piece really develops multiples of increased efficiency and efficacy of the skills that we have within that central AI capability.
So you mentioned structured data there. It might be useful to just talk a little bit about the sort of size and nature of the data and the data sets that you're drawing on in your particular line of work in the sort of decision science area.
Sure. I mean, it won't surprise you to learn that it's colossal, of course, in a bank of our size and with the number of interactions that we have with our customers. And so we like to think about the way that we set ourselves up to provide great service to our customers in kind of three ways structurally around data. So one is the data layer itself. how do you make sure that all of the data that we're using is robust, well-defined, well-governed, you know, it turns up on time, we understand where it comes from, and we manage that process very well. Then we think about the intelligence layer on top of that. How do we think about using that data asset to produce predictive models, insights, analytics, things that are better for our customers based on what we understand about their interactions with us? And the third is kind of distribution. So how do you then use that intelligence to get out to customers or out to our kind of operations teams and actually have that information and insight and predictive capability make a difference? And I guess one really good example that I can give you of the scale that we're talking about is our customer engagement engine. So this is AI-powered technology within our bank that coordinates all of the next best conversations that we have with our customers across our 20-plus channels. So how do we understand what is the most relevant thing to talk to you about as a customer, no matter how you choose to bank with us? And then AI helps us coordinate all of our data to try to make the best possible conversation starter for our frontline or the best possible experience for you in the Combank app. That works off hundreds of machine learning models that have processed 157 billion data points. So that gives you some idea of the kind of scale that we're working with.
Mm. And how much of your work is impacted or has an effect in terms of streaming data and real-time data? Obviously, next best conversation, I think you would have maybe some lead time in terms of being able to come up with the next insight that might drive the follow-on conversation with that customer. Is real-time data increasingly being ingested either into CEE or into some of the other work that you're undertaking?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, real time is really important to us. There are times when batch is sufficient, but times when you've got to be relevant in the moment. And actually, CE is an example of a system that is using real time data. I can give you a great recent example for this. Unfortunately, there have been some terrible floods in Australia. And when that happens, the bank has an assistance package for our customers to help let them know that we're there for them and provides a range of support in their moment of need. Back in the olden days, we would have this package and customers would be entitled to it, but maybe wouldn't know that it was available. And so if the customer went into the branch or called up, they would be in the local area. If you're going to a local branch, they of course will know that the area has been flooded. In fact, the branch itself may have been closed due to flooding. So the customer will need to call up. And the problem there is Australia is such a huge country. If you call somebody, you might be speaking to somebody hundreds of miles away who might not necessarily know in that moment that the next best conversation for you, the thing that we should do above all else, is recognize that you're in a high stress situation and that we should be talking to you about the assistance that we can give you in that context right now. And so real-time data is actually critical in that type of scenario. Many of the next best conversations that we have with our customers necessarily have to be fed by real-time data in order to be most helpful.
Real-time data in that instance, is that drawn from an external source or is that through some sort of internal data matching exercise?
So in the case of natural disaster, there are a range of different data sources available publicly. And one of the things that we do is we wrote a smart data model to try to understand all of the different possible events that can occur. You know, in many different jurisdictions, states, different types of activity, bushfire versus floods versus drought. The data sources that are available out there publicly to everyone can be in different formats or completely different styles of approach. So we do the work internally to process those through our smart data model to make sure that we're consistent. And then we can apply that at the customer level to try to be relevant to individuals based on what we know is happening in the world right now.
In terms of the decision science environment, I understand the technology that underpins that to a degree, but I wondered if you could just give us a sense of some of the technology platforms and architecture that you're using, and particularly if there are standards or certain ways of work that you use when approaching your discipline within the bank.
Sure. I mean, one of the really exciting things that we've done over the past couple of years and are really ramping up now across the entire enterprise is our investment in a centralized AI capability that is for everybody. And one of the key tools in our arsenal there is H2O.ai. This is a company out of Silicon Valley. And effectively what this tooling does is kind of like AI for AI. So if you think about how data science traditionally happens in most places right now, you take a problem area, you get the data surrounding that problem area, and you take a data scientist and they try to create predictive models. They hand code it themselves, they clean the data, they think about different types of technique, they get an outcome, they train the data, They then tune hyperparameters. They go back and they try another technique. And that process involves a real expert, but it can take many weeks, even months sometimes, to keep continually refining. What H2O does is automate that process. So it will look through every possible combination of each of the latest and greatest techniques in modeling and data science, plow through all of them automatically, tune features on the fly, combine multiple different models to get the right outcome. And what you find there is that you can get an incredibly predictive model, literally at the touch of a button. It's an incredibly simple user interface. You provide the data, you flag what feature you want to try to predict. Let's say a customer may have a particular propensity for a particular type of service that we want to provide to them. Is it helpful or not? Did the customer like this or not? And then the H2O technology will automatically churn out an incredibly predictive data model so that we can use that then to be relevant to our customers. And I think there are three reasons why this approach is so important for us at CommBank. The first is that H2O, in providing an automated platform for generating really accurate modeling, means that we can democratize the use of, you know, we're an AI first company these days. And in order to do that, we have to enable many, many more of our employees to be able to have access to great intelligence and insight to be able to serve customers better. And so in the context of your first question around the size of the organization, you can see how this allows us to produce much better business and customer outcomes by empowering people to have access to tooling that previously would have been beyond their skill capability. The second is that it allows a really robust framework for us to govern and control the application of this technology. So it comes with enterprise standard controls around explainability. How can we understand how the models are producing the outcomes that they do? Bias detection. So how can we make sure that we're not having disparity in the way that we serve different subsets of customers? How can we make sure that we have really robust controls for anything that gets put into production? So we know what went live, when, under what circumstances we can audit it. And that way we can ensure that we have a really robust framework for the way that we serve customers in a way that is consistent with our purpose to try to give them a brighter future and improve their financial well-being. And the third, and probably I'm biased, but I'm very excited about this particular part, is just the scale of the expertise that it gives us access to. If you're familiar with chess and the concept of a chess grandmaster, I think there are about 1,700 chess grandmasters in the world. For data science, there's a community online, a kind of platform called Kaggle, which organizes competitions for data science. So it'll provide kind of open source data sets and invite anybody in the world, enthusiasts, experts, to try to solve the most predictive possible model for a particular use case. And if you win a competition, you get a gold medal. If you win a lot of competitions, you become what's called a Kaggle grandmaster. So the equivalent of a kind of chess grandmaster, but for data science. And there are, I think, somewhere around 200 or so of those in the world. And H2O have, I think, 10% of all of those Kaggle grandmasters, including a large number of the top 10. So suddenly we have access to literally the very best data scientists in the entire world working on problems for CBA, for the Commonwealth Bank, for our customers. And that's an incredibly exciting thing for us to be a part of.
Okay, just to dig into a couple of things there. Firstly, when you democratize the creation of models, how do you maybe prevent having a situation where all parts of the business are just spinning up a lot of models and you get essentially a model sprawl environment starting to take shape?
So there are two answers to that question. One is around the technology and one is around the governance. And really to describe how the situation unfolds, you need to understand the difference between a kind of production model, so something that's going to run in a system continually, like the customer engagement engine that we spoke about is a good example of something that we know has to be performant, has to be well managed, well governed, needs to not fall over, needs to be monitored for model drift and all of these other things that can happen as data evolves over time. And the second is kind of exploratory analysis. How do we think about maybe designing a new product? What do we think might happen? What do we think customers will like? Before you've pushed something into production, you have the ability to create modeling that helps understand customer behavior and is useful in a kind of ad hoc context without needing to go to the full production scale. But in all instances, any of the models that we use within the business are subject to our group model policy. Now, the bank has been running on models for many, many years, decades, right? All banks have. And so we already have a very robust framework in place that manages the documentation of models. Where do they sit? Where do they go live? What data features do they use? How often are they audited and checked and so forth? So there's an incredibly robust framework there. And that's no different for our AI models as well. They go through the exact same robust governance. And we also check for some of the interesting new things that happen with AI around explainability and disparity as the models become more complex. It was very important to us that we put in place these checks to make sure that they were happening in a responsible way that we were comfortable with. And so from a technology perspective, if you're pushing a model into production, the type of environment that you might use could be different to the one that you would use if you were doing that kind of ad hoc space. And that's how we're able to both innovate and not stifle creativity, but also be safe and secure and robust for our customers. An example of the latter might be something like our smart builds hub technology. So within the Combank app, in addition to all of the things that the customer engagement engine does, we're able to predict customers' likely bills. And that's based on 21 machine learning models. I think these days running over something like 19 billion data points. And obviously that's production grade in the Combank app. It has to be up and it has to be accurate and helping our customers. And so the framework and technology that is being run on every day can be different to some of the things that we do in the exploratory sense as we democratize AI.
The other aspect you mentioned there was that more parts of the business will be able to create models and to take advantage of things that perhaps would be potentially beyond their skill capabilities. The flip side of that is, while this resolves a bottleneck in terms of potentially staff resources for CBA, I wonder how this challenges the existing staff in terms of a lot of technology people see their point of differentiation or their unique value proposition as having this broad knowledge of tools and of models and of that technical domain. So I just wondered if you had any commentary around creating that balance, for example.
That's a great question, right? And I think the answer I would give was around my description of the aspects of why H2O.ai was such an attractive partner for us, because I think it answers both of those two types of use case. One where you democratize and lower the barrier to entry for analysts or modelers who don't necessarily have a background in data science to produce more meaningful insights for themselves and their business partners than might otherwise be the case. But you also have the very, very high end. So as I said, the H2O have, I think it's 17 Kaggle Grandmasters in their ranks, and we get to work with those every day. So we have some brilliant data scientists, some of the best in Australia, working with some of the best in the world. And actually, these people are kind of unleashed. So suddenly there's a whole community of people who understand what the possibilities are and have access to some of the tooling and capability that previously they could only dream of. So the way that H2O thinks about this is, if I'm a Kaggle Grandmaster, let's say, if I'm one of the best data scientists in the world, how do I produce the flexibility within the system to produce an environment that allows me to do my best work? Now, that type of environment and that kind of pattern of access of the platform that we've built for AI is probably only specific to those who really understand the deep code, some of the most advanced techniques. But for those people in the organization who, as you say, had their kind of technical capability as their kind of USP, suddenly they're able to really unleash what they're capable of for the business. So it's kind of win-win everywhere, I think.
It sounds like you're going to use H2O quite broadly within the bank. And obviously, that will be very useful for some of the newer models and use cases. What about some of the existing models? Is there opportunities to take some of those and pass them through a tool like H2O and potentially come up with different or newer ways to solve the same kind of challenge or better ways to solve that challenge, for example?
Oh, 100%. I mean, one of the things about the AI capability that Combank has is, by definition, it's continually evolving, learning, upgrading. Some of those models literally are kind of self-learning models that continually refine as we get more and more data. And sometimes, under the way that we operate, we are continually refining the techniques that we've used. We'll look at the outcomes that we've had, and as new capability or new techniques become available to us, we'll continually upgrade those. So I think we'll kind of retrofit H2O modeling and just more advanced data science and AI modeling of any type to all of the bank's operations. But one of the things that's also exciting to us is it opens up new opportunities for things we've never done before. And that's a really exciting thing for our customers. If we think about the way that every time we use our best people, our most difficult and challenging areas to produce better outcomes, we get great results. And now suddenly we're able to do that at a scale that vastly outstrips what we've been able to do in the past.
I had a question about the openness and sharing between different teams and different lines of business and business units within the bank. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you potentially look at reusing things that are developed, so models that might be developed in one aspect or area of the bank, but it might have broad applicability to other parts of the bank as well.
Yes. So one of the key, I think, advantages of the way that we've structured decision science within the bank is that it allows us to propagate some of the brilliant capabilities that we develop more widely. I think a couple of years back, we had the first production use case of deep learning within the bank, which was looking at customer feedback and then trying to group together themes. So if we were trying to understand what were the types of things that our customers were saying to us that they wanted from us, we use deep learning to understand related themes and the large constellation of things that were going, make rational sense of those and then provide the right kind of focus on what we needed to fix. That same technique and the capability that we developed there is now being used in multiple different contexts throughout the bank. So anywhere where we have unstructured verbatim data, and there are lots of examples in the bank in terms of documentation, the way that we deal with our broker network for home buying, many, many different types of unstructured text problems, all of which benefit from that. And also, it works both ways. As we've democratized and socialized the power of AI, we're starting to see other areas of the bank who have developed incredible capability being able to get even better at it. There's no better example of this, I think, than our Benefits Finder solution for our customers. So this was something that was developed in the CommBank app, I think, a couple of years ago now, which aggregates all of the various different state and federal rebates or benefits that are available to customers, from compulsory third-party insurance rebates to toll rebates and all sorts of stuff. Hundreds and hundreds of these possible things, but for customers, quite hard to know what they're entitled to and get access to it sometimes. So we thought we could create a feature within the CommBank app that made it simple for our customers to get access to the money that they're entitled to. And so this is a brilliant piece of work by our behavioral scientists and our digital teams to produce this capability. And now using AI and data science, we're able to continually refine that and get more and more accurate and helpful in the way that we present those possibilities to our customers. And we've now realized for our customers a benefit of more than $500 million returned to our customers of money that they were entitled to through this route. It's a really good example of how you get symbiosis across the organization and better outcomes. We've become better than the sum of our parts.
And speaking of the sum of the parts, are there any particular parts or particular business units or functions within the bank that are really pushing the envelope or the limits in terms of what's possible, particularly in the decision science space, but also maybe more broadly around data science and analytics and AI?
Yeah, I think one of the great things in the model is that there's really no limitation on which part of the organization can be pushing the boundaries in this space, because they all have access now democratized to the same capability. But I think some of the really exciting things that we do are in greenfield sites. So we were thinking about how do we make sure that we use our customer feedback data to produce better products and services in a particular line of business. And one of the things that we noticed is that as we were kind of formulating the models to try to predict what we think would work, what would resonate well and be helpful, was that some of the data sets that we had for this particular area were limited in their ability to help train the model. And so we use a technique called active learning. So some of our best AI scientists create a capability to introduce an expert labeling tool for our staff to use that allows the training of the models in a much cleverer way. So we identify which area of our model is kind of lacking some more information that would help it to become more predictive about what would be helpful. And that allows us to get to the outcome quicker. That allows us to actually get better use of the experts in our team who are kind of labeling this data to say, yes, this means this means something else. And so that kind of thing, I think, is very exciting. I think the other thing that I would say about where the organization is very progressive and forward thinking is in terms of the kind of societal aspects of the work that we do. So as we said at the outset, my team very consciously decision science, not specifically data science. We understand there's a social human aspect to this. And we've partnered with Macquarie University, one of the first of the kind studies that is happening anywhere in the world, to commence a national study program to attain a deep understanding into the various complex trends and emerging financial challenges and opportunities that are facing young adult Australians. And the study program is going to use mixed research methods, unique observations, studies, experiments with a young adult cohort observed in their real life environment over 4 consecutive years. And that's really going to help inform how we shape the bank of the future to be what our customers, what the future generations of Australians would like it to be. And that will, of course, then have implications for the way that we do AI. But it's a really progressive way of thinking about customer research, customer focus, to put us down a path that is maybe different to what other banks have done in the past.
Just touching on the ethics side of things as well, obviously CBA has done a lot of work around AI ethics principles and the development of those principles. Something we've seen recently up in the region in Singapore is more work around instrumenting or wrapping metrics around ethics and fairness in the algorithms and trying to automate parts of the monitoring to recognize potential exceedance of some of the tolerances, I guess. I'm really curious for your commentary on this as an organization that did a lot of work on AI ethics principles in Australia. How much of the recognition should be manual or how much should be sort of automated?
It's a great question. And you're right. Obviously, the concept of ethics, fairness, transparency, fundamental to the way that we approach AI in CommBank and has been for many years. I mean, prior to the ethics framework that you referred to, the ethics principles for the Australian Department of Industry, we already created some groundbreaking tooling within the bank around explainability and disparity detection because we recognized that as we access this incredible capability, we needed to make sure that we were using it responsibly, transparently, fairly, and that we had to not only meet but exceed community expectation on this. And so it was great to work on those AI ethics principles and see them being applied every day in the work that we do. I think there's probably an important balance to be had here, which is that there's a great degree of technological and process control that needs to be applied to the implementation of this kind of technology. And we've talked a little already on this chat about how we think about model governance, how the tooling and capability that we have with H2O.ai and some of the other parts of our technology stack actually track and record the explainability of the models, audit the progress of those and the disparity across different groups so we can be confident about the model performance acting within what we expected broadly to be the outcomes. But you have to have a human in the loop. I don't think you can solve definitively algorithmically for what is fair or what is not. And so at each stage of that journey, from the point at which we think about the business problem to the way that we develop the algorithm and think about the data that's underpinning it, to the implementation, to the end use and tracking of outcomes, every single part of that has a tremendous amount of human oversight from multiple parts of the organization to check that what we're implementing for our customers not only meets their expectation, but exceeds it.
One thing you mentioned there was H2O being part of the technology stack. Are you able to give us a sense of a more complete view of the technology stack that you're working towards? Obviously, H2O is a pretty exciting one, but there are obviously other ones as well that I'm aware of and may not be aware of. Sure.
It's obviously a very comprehensive technology stack that we have, and it depends entirely on the use case exactly which bits of it will be used for what. But in the case of, say, underlying modeling applications like thinking about core banking operations or some of the cool things that we do in the CommBank app that I described earlier, we have a well-governed, robust data layer. The proprietary analytics workbench capability that we built on top of that then manages the process of getting a discovery environment for that data, the ability to cleanse it, create features within that using H2O and proprietary coding in some instances. You know, you can use R, Python, whatever is appropriate for a particular type of use case. Some of our best models are still homegrown, so to speak. So we have some of the very best data scientists in Australia producing novel solutions, and they can only possibly do that by being free to create innovative and new things. It all happens on that same analytics workbench platform and then gets pushed into production jobs, which again is our kind of stack of how we think about monitoring performance over time. And so there's a whole range of tools and technologies in there. The overall end-to-end process is obviously proprietary, but there are a number of underlying technologies within that stack.
One of the things I've asked everyone on the podcast, including last year, but also this year, is what excites you about the coming year? I feel like you've mentioned quite a few things that are exciting, but maybe just give us a top line perspective about what really is driving you forward for this year.
For me, I think the thing that excites me most is our ability to generate new capability for not just CBA customers, but for the broader Australian population and actually the world. We talked a little bit about the terrible situation with the floods recently. Actually, in partnership with H2O, we're currently having a global wildfire and bushfire challenge, which is like one of those Kaggle competitions open to everybody in the world. We're just in the final stages of judging that. So teams from across the world have started to create incredible new capability to think about the way to predict the spreads of these events. And that's going to help us to get ahead of it, not just for our customers, but first responders or communities, businesses. And so we will be able to package up that kind of capability and make it available more broadly to everybody. So the thing that excites me most about the next year is not just that we're producing great stuff for our customers, but that we can produce great stuff for everybody.
Hi, I'm Nate Cochran, contributing editor for IT News and CRN. And with me is Dave McKinnon, Chief Security Officer for Enable. Dave's last job was IT security leader at one of the world's biggest media companies, where he protected a diverse and dispersed workforce from a variety of sophisticated attacks. Dave will explain what IT pros and managed service providers need to know about defending the burgeoning remote workforce. And he'll share his views on the benefits of automation and insight for security operations boosting their own productivity and capacity. Dave, welcome. Enable may be a clean skin for some of our listeners, but you've been around for a while. Tell us about the security vendor.
We've been around for almost 20 years. We were an organization that grew organically to support classic VARs and MSPs to support their customers, which really are what drive a lot of economies for many countries. So we started out doing remote monitoring and management, and we grew that business, supporting backup, email security solutions, remote access and administration, among other things. And what that's really given us the opportunity to do as a business is grow into the IT pro market. The challenges exist between both, but there's an inflection point for most larger organizations where they need the support of their own internal teams. And our tools are extensible that they can support those organizations as they grow to those levels beyond what kind of a classic MSP would be supporting.
What do these two groups have in common? What do they need to know about this free range or hybrid style of work? And is it here to stay?
First and foremost is labor shortage. The remote workforce is helping many organizations to combat those challenges. And this is really the new norm as I view it. And in order to support an employee, a workforce that wants to be remote, I think that folks don't want to return back to an office 5 days a week. They want to live wherever they want to live. Australia is a huge country. They can go wherever they want. And having the ability to effectively support those users, whether you're an MSP or an IT pro, is critical to supporting your business and driving them to be successful. Classically, you go to an office every day and your office was a castle. You know, enterprises invested in technologies to protect those users. Those walls have gone away. You know, I work in an office here in Atlanta, which I'm by myself. I'm one of the only employees in this state for Enable. And all of those controls have now moved to the endpoint. And many organizations have the challenge of figuring out, well, how do you support that in this new normal? So being able to remotely administer, remotely support those users, set them up for success should they have problems, because the reality is technology is prone to have issues. So putting your employees or your customers from the MSP perspective in a position where you can very effectively support their needs in this new hybrid workforce, which I really do believe is here to stay.
So what distinguishes the businesses with the most successful hybrid workforces, and what can we learn from their lived experience?
You know, I think the classic state of mind, old school, would be, I see somebody in a seat, they're doing their job. That's how I measure whether or not they're a good employee, versus really embracing the remote workforce to understand that employee happiness is driven by a number of things. You know, if you have to bring your child to a doctor's appointment or you want to go to a sports game, and having that workforce flexibility to effectively do your work wherever you happen to be sitting, and candidly, probably working more than you would if you're dealing with a commute in it to and from the office every day where you're trying to rush to meet all these deadlines. So the organizations who embrace that early on, and everybody was enforced to embrace it 2 years ago, but continue to grow it, they're going to become the employer of choice. It's where people are going to want to work because it supports the lifestyle that they've grown accustomed to.
So for the MSP or the IT pro who is listening to us now, what do they need to know to deliver the best support to their end customers most efficiently?
Advice I got probably 15 plus years ago when I was at ISS was, if you're doing something every day and you hate it, automate it out of your world. And Enable is a platform that allows you to do that. So whether you want to automate pushing patches out, whether you want to automate configuring workstations, whether you want to automate password rotations so that the local accounts are secured, whatever the case may be, having a solution that empowers organizations to do that is absolutely critical. And then you layer onto that the ability to support them, you know, where they're not necessarily in the classic office environment anymore. And then finally, making sure that you're backing them up and preparing for worst case scenario, a hardware failure or some other major catastrophic event, and doing it more than, you know, once a week. That is absolutely critical for organizations to be successful in this new virtual workforce.
Australia is a pretty big place, and add New Zealand into the mix, and it's an even larger geography that a lot of our listeners have to cover. How does Enable specifically help them, say, with regards to remote monitoring and managing?
we started remote. I mean, the classic MSP market was not somebody in an office every day. It was a centralized management of devices that are dispersed across an organization. Add to that the tenancy. So we've always had the concept of a single MSP would manage multiple customers. You can do that same thing as an enterprise. So if you have an enterprise with multiple different divisions that are spread across the country or even internationally, being able to effectively have your local teams that could support the organization, but all doing it in a continuous, consistent manner is absolutely critical. And that's the problem. Everybody has too many tools to do all the things. And keeping it simple is the best path forward.
So looking ahead to the threat landscape, what is it that Australian IT pros and their end customers and MSPs need to look out for?
We just released a study a couple of weeks ago talking about in the MSP space, roughly 90% of MSPs have had a successful security event in the last 18 months. And a lot of that for me, I think, is awareness. Over the last few years, you cannot read any news source without seeing something about security, and whether it be ransomware or anything else, those attacks continue to proliferate. So whether ransomware is coming via email, it's coming from failure to patch, and it's coming from open services to the internet where you don't have proper controls, that will continue to be the sweet spot for threat actors. Until we make it hard for them, they're going to live off the land. The other half of it is really the war that's going on in Eastern Europe. As that continues to escalate, really watching, is there any fallout from those events that, while not directed at the IT pro or the MSP environments, there may just be waves of threats that are attacking us as a result of it, just because that's the way cyber warfare works. So I think those would be the two big things to watch over the next 12 to 18 months as those two trends continue.
Dave McKinnon from Enable, thank you very much for joining us today to talk about IT security in the distributed and dispersed workforces.
And that's the podcast for this week. We'll be back with an exciting new interview next week. Until then, you can catch all the latest headlines in Australian IT over at itnews.com.au.